Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
There was a little bit of uncertainty immediately after yesterday's Manchester derby, just about who was going to get the match ball, given the two players that scored hat-tricks for the same team in the same game. Erling Haaland was confidently striding around with it tucked under his arm before Ilkay Gundogan hilariously punched it out of there and delivered it to Phil Foden. We all know Haaland was going to rip it back out of Foden's arms as soon as they got back to the dressing room.
Arms and all.
Before some genius worked out that actually there's loads of match balls knocking around. Why don't we just give you one each? Welcome to Monday Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, guys.
Hello,
Owen. How are you?
If there had only been the one match ball, though, it got me thinking. The only fair way to decide it would have been which hat-trick was more impressive. Would you be giving it to Haaland or Foden? Two very, very fine hat-tricks.
Let me think. Foden's first goal was the finish from the foot across.
Lovely sweeping finish. Yeah. He was involved in the move beforehand as well. The second one I loved because absolute lung-busting run to get up there. And actually, Malacia was the one who got hauled off at halftime.
Yeah.
I actually thought...
He'd been booked after a couple of
minutes. It's true, yeah. But in that case, I actually thought he tracked the run pretty well for 99.9% of it. And then, you know, there's only so much he could have done. Foden scores that. And then the last one, was that the one that...
Haaland played him through diagonal five-man United line.
But then you got your Haaland hat-trick, which was also pretty good.
For me, Owen, I'm going with Erling Haaland. Yeah. I'm going with the goal.
Caught
Yeti.
Up with the hype.
Yeah.
It was... I mean, come on. This is just...
I want to narrow it down again. What was the best goal out of Haaland's three?
The second one, probably.
De Bruyne across.
Yeah. I think that was the moment where everyone was like, okay, so there's literally no way to stop this team. This is it now. They hand them over the league title now. This is just, this could get ugly.
Well, you never know. I mean,
in a very pretty way.
Does he cost them a bit of stability?
Yeah, I know. Like that's a big question.
Let's keep clinging to those those little straws.
Well, we are obviously running out of superlatives. Mm-hmm. Guardiola, I see, has pretty much been... Well, he now is just expressing his appreciation through the medium of dance, like the bears of the technical area. I don't know. I mean, he put on some show. Were you watching him like during the interview? I thought, wow, I haven't really seen it. Could be the roomier pants that he now wears.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
He's wearing roomier lower crotch pants.
The combats actually didn't last that long at all. I mean, I know that.
Oh, I think, do these not have tactical pockets?
I think
there's a lot of tactical.
Was there?
Yeah.
I think all I noticed was the roomier. With the roomier, just he's just giving himself a way
he's
more.
Getting a little bit, he's getting a little bit older.
He's
we all
move.
Ultimately get roomier pants as we get older.
Don't try and lump us in with Pep Guardiola. He's got like 8% body fat. Or
did he bust his pants? I mean, I
sorry, that should definitely be a hotkey.
Well, I've seen,
the way that you.
It's happened to a few managers. I mean, I can remember it happening to Mourinho when he did that celebration. Was that actually a game against City? Was it a Madrid home win when he was the Madrid manager? It may have been Man City. And he jumped out on the pitch and did a kind of a knee slide, but his he didn't obviously he doesn't probably do that many knee slides.
Yeah.
And his execution wasn't great, and he bust the gusset of his pants. Zidane obviously did it a couple of times, just walking around on the touchline, I think. You know, he's a big man.
Well, yeah, but to be fair, he didn't leave himself any room to
breathe. I think
there.
It has happened to Guardiola as well. Mm. But that it seems like we've moved away from the days of very tight chinos to a more, well, I mean, Guardiola is you know, he brings a very liberatory vibe now to the, he just wears what he likes now. You know, was it Luis Enrique who kind of led this? You know, he's like, you know, I'm not going to make any effort at all. Or it's just artful, you know, lack of effort, let's say.
The sort of lack of effort that you spend 45 minutes on.
But he did. Guardiola was just absolutely...
He tried. He tried to win the Champions League without the best player in the world, and he failed. So now he's just going to go back to doing what he does best, which is winning the Champions League with the best player in the world. So listen... if I was Pep Guardiola, I'd be feeling like I'd be D-mob happy as well. I tried football management. It went well, it went bad. Who cares? At the end of the day, I could just go out and get the best player in the world, and that's also fine. Yeah. That also goes in my win column. So, just throw his hands up. Let's be happy. Everyone just relax.
Hey, let's stick with the fashion here for a second, because I have some good news for you, Murph.
Go on.
I've seen some of your second captain's wardrobe recently. Let's say you're in need of a crisp new T-shirt there.
Oh, here. I actually am wearing one now.
And it's are you?
Horribly faded.
That's one of the old black ones. It's an old black World Service.
Yeah.
With a bit of red World Service.
It's seen better days.
Yeah, come on.
I mean, I've been wearing it. This is probably my 800th wear.
What better way to re-up your wardrobe than by getting your hands on a classic? Last week, we asked our listeners if we should restock the old Euro 88 captain T-shirt. Mm. Green second captain's T-shirt with the captain's armband. A beautiful piece of work. I got to say, we had nearly 2,000 votes cast, believe it or not, with 91% of people saying yes for me. 9% of respondents, that's nearly 200 people, took time out of their day to tell us, no, we don't want this jersey. Not for me. Well, screw you guys. Mm. We're going with the overwhelming majority.
And this could have been Jamie Heath's Should I Start a Podcast? But thankfully, it wasn't.
Yeah. We're going to reissue the most popular T-shirt we've ever had, our World Service members. We'll get first word on that during the week. Also this week on the World Service, it gives me great pleasure to announce, in honour of the late, great Coolio, second captain's 90s hip hop week.
You want to talk about a playmaker?
Owen McDevitt from Ireland's second captain show.
That's a playmaker.
The Second Captain's Podcast.
All fired into the coming rushes.
The Second Captain's Podcast.
It's finger licking good. Special.
Smush it.
Now, I'm going to tell you this too.
Smush it.
I have been hurting.
Smush it.
Because I have been having to tell the truth about
Second Captain's show in Ireland.
It's something finger licking good special. That's what I'm talking about. And they do look great because we got that finger licking ass right.
Just one more finger licking. Oh no,
another one.
Oh, it's happening. All will be revealed on your second captain's Monday podcast later on today. But all you really need to know is that we're ready to hear your 90s hip hop suggestions on Twitter at Second Captains or email editor@secondcaptains.com with the subject title 90s hip hop. Shout out to Mark Horgan, who's working very hard on a new series with the BBC. But as soon as he heard the passion in my voice for this new musically themed week of programming, he simply had to get involved and has spent an inordinate amount of time. We're somewhere in the region of 72 hours holed up in a bunker coming up with that audio bit.
I thought Claire Byrne, the addition of Claire Byrne there right in the middle of that was just top class.
I can't help but feel top Michael tier. Irvin came into Mark's life at just the right time as well.
Finger licking good special.
For more finger looking good analysis of the week's Champions League, including Liverpool Rangers tomorrow night.
I have been hurting.
Oh no. Oh, so you're back in studio. Simon's firing these things in left, right and centre.
Mm.
Love it, Simon. You're going to need to be signed up to the World Service to hear all our Champions League during the week. Secondcaptains.com, €5 a month, plus VAT. Ken, please, report on sport.
So Guardiola obviously wouldn't be Guardiola if he didn't point out there were still some areas of potential improvement. After the game... Yeah, obviously there was plenty of praise, but you know, it was 9 out of 10. It was 9.2, 9.3 out of 10. There's still, you know, 0.7, 0.8% 0.8 of out of 10, 7 or 8%.
yep.
of improvement that can be done here. Shall we hear what Guardiola thinks can be improved by his superhero?
He's involved in the game. He said one thing: I prefer to touch 5 times the ball and score 5 goals. I don't like it that. I want to be involved. He can touch more ball. So he became a football player to score the goals, but to touch that feeling that only the football players can feel, to be in contact with the ball. I like that he's part as well for that situation. Don't forget that his biggest talent is put the ball in the net, and that is a fantastic, fantastic strike.
Yes.
I don't know that Haaland really mean that comment. I saw when he said that.
It's a joke.
Yeah, he's been asked, and again, it's in the context
he's responded
of, Haaland, you score a lot of goals, but you know you don't really actually touch the ball that much.
Yeah.
It's almost like a criticism that in his head, I'd say. Yeah. So he's like, well, like 5 touches, 5 goals, that'd be great.
That'd be good. I'd be happy with that. And that's kind of almost what he's doing. It's like, what is this? Like, what? This is crazy. You know, it's...
Don't forget the other touches for the assists.
Yeah.
5 touches, 3 goals, 2 assists.
Yeah,
that's also good.
That was all right. Yeah, but you know, it is it's pretty incredible. He did that interview with Gary Neville. I mentioned he said he could improve physically in a number of areas. That's where he saw the possible improvement. Just more.
Yeah.
I want more of this. although he did admit that you know he's not. He does even Erling Haaland has moments of doubt.
I'm often nervous. Yeah,
you don't look it.
I'm not, but. You're normally nervous maybe before the game, but when you come into it, for me, my whole life, I've been kind of using football as a kind of getaway, you know, when I had maybe a bad day at school, or if I was, my father were mad at me, I went to the pitch and then I forgot everything, you know, a bit like this. And this is something I still have, but yeah, I'm nervous, as I think everybody else in this world. You don't have to hide that. I'm nervous. I'm sometimes anxious or whatever, but I think that's a part of life. And I think it's about still being focused while you're nervous, you know, to try to still do the right things, even when you're a bit uncomfortable.
I think he comes across really well there. I thought, you know, we've talked about Haaland's post-match persona.
Yeah.
But when he sat down, maybe with somebody he has a certain amount of respect for, I don't know, or it's just
even at that.
Yeah, how many goals would I have scored with Gary Neville playing playing in the defence for Manchester United, is probably what he was thinking during that conversation. But it was a nice relaxed environment. I thought that was one of the best clips there, probably the best one. He just sounded like, I mean, he still also sounded super confident in other areas. It's like, listen, if I make the run,
nobody can stop me.
If I time my run, he kept talking about that timing. If I time my run correctly, then basically.
Well, there was that moment in the game, you know, where he hit the outside of the post when, I forget what this was, Silva maybe, Grealish, I'm not sure which player played the through ball, maybe Gundogan it was, where he ran from a central position just in front of Lisandro Martinez, who could see him because he was right there in front of him, but there was just nothing he could do. You know, you just see Haaland, his whole face just, he's like, you know, the ball is coming through and Lisandro can't, I mean, he did, in fairness, get across, so he had to kind of hit the shot first time, but if the shot was on target in the bottom corner instead of the outside of the post, I think that's got to be another goal.
It's funny because Neville was framing like, you're so big, you're so physical, you're so strong. It's like an adult playing with 10-year-olds or whatever.
And 5-year-olds.
The way Haaland answered it was like, when he was talking about the timing of the run, was, I'm so fast, which is a very different thing. You know, it's like, don't just talk about me like I'm some sort of monster here. I run really, really fast.
The neck to him was as the bole of a great oak, knotted and seized together with muscle humps and carbuncles of tangled sinew, the better for good feasting and contending with the birds.
Henry Winter.
The chest to him was wider than the poles of a good chariot, coming now in, now out, now in, pastured from chin to navel with meadows of black man hair, meated with layers of fine man meat, the better to hide his bones and fashion the semblance of his twin bubs, etc. Who has seen the like of Erling, or seen the living semblance of him standing in the world? Erling that could best God at ball throw, or wrestling, or pig trailing, or at the honeyed discourse of sweet Irish, Norwegian, I suppose, with jewels and gold for bards, or at the listening of distant harpers in a black hole at evening. Where is the living human man who could beat Erling at the making of generous cheese, at the spearing of ganders, at the magic of thumbsuck, the shaving of hog hair, or the unleashing of longhounds from a golden thong in the full chase? Sweet-fingered corn-yellow Erling, Erling that could carry an armed host from Alma to Slieve Lucre in the craw of his gut-hung knickers.
Hang on, Sweet Finger, was that Michael Irvin?
Sweet fingered.
Finger licking good, is that what the,
yeah. I mean, it's just crazy. And you know,
sorry, what were we just listening to there? We should.
You don't recognize?
No. It's not Tim Pat Coogan's biography of Michael Collins.
No. No, it's one of the Finn McCool sections of At Swim Two Birds, which is really the only place where I've ever seen superlatives on the scale that really, you know, I just think he's shown the only way to really speak about this guy.
Big Erling.
The nose to his white whey face. The mouth to his white whey face had dimensions and measurements to the width of Ulster, bordered by a red lip wall and inhabited unseen by the watchful host of his honey yellow teeth, to the size each with each of a corn stack. And in the dark hollow to each tooth there was home and fullness for the sitting there of a thorny dog, or for the lying there of a spear-pierced badger. To each of the two eyes in his head was their eye hair to the fashion of a young forest. To the colour of each great eyeball was as the slaughter of a host in snow.
Listen, United were humiliated yesterday, but there are no badgers were harmed in the making of this 6-3. I think we should make that perfectly clear.
It really is.
He's a big lad, and he's not afraid to throw it about, Ken. Let's be honest.
I mean, it's literally that at this point, it's like, when is he going to get bored of this?
Mm.
Yeah, everyone just has to wait now for Erling Haaland to get bored of success.
Mm.
And then
what's his injury profile like? He doesn't get injured, nah, really, does he?
Well, he got injured. Actually, Guardiola said something interesting in the press conference yesterday. He said, well, the physios are winning games for us. And he mentioned the fact that the doctors at Dortmund hadn't been able to get Haaland on the pitch all the time, because he missed quite a few games last season. But our doctors have. And shout out to the doctors. You don't often hear managers say in a post-match press conference they've just hammered Man United.
Well, maybe Dortmund were more jealously guarding the millions of euro that they were definitely going to get as long as Erling Haaland didn't suffer a catastrophic injury, whereas City have already paid the huge millions, or the many millions.
Yeah, well, not as much on the transfer fee, obviously, but I'm sure he's getting quite a lot of money.
I wonder what his hat-trick bonus is. I mean, if his hat-trick bonus is sizable, then he's really having a badder couple of weeks.
So, Erik ten Hag, I was surprised to see, you know, the Manchester Evening News, for instance, criticising ten Hag, I think Sam Lucker saying, you know, too passive. I mean, ten Hag did say this himself, like that the approach of the team was too passive. But I thought the team that he selected was quite attacking. Too attacking. You know, I can see how he didn't want to change what had been a successful formula for the games against Liverpool and Arsenal, the two big teams that United have already beaten. And it was basically the same setup as in those teams, not exactly the same lineup, but the same setup. This game is, you know, an away game against City, the way they're going with Haaland. You know, I really wonder if maybe, did he need the two wingers? I mean, they were hardly involved. Antony obviously scored a brilliant goal, but was it really a day for that? You know, Fernandes and Eriksen, both in midfield, with Rashford up front. Well, you know, he talked about if our approach, you know, on the front foot, he kept saying if we'd been on the front foot, rather than sort of constantly rocked back by these punches that they were getting from City, metaphorical punches, then it might have been different, but I'm not sure.
Well, we were kind of lauding Eriksen in that deeper midfield role, but after the Arsenal game, but I don't know, when you look at it, Eriksen, you're asking a lot from Scott McTominay there, put it that way. If you've got Eriksen and Bruno in that sort of area as well, you're looking for McTominay to be really all action. And you might be asking more than Scott McTominay is capable of.
I mean, you don't want to really drop either one of Ferdinand Fernandes or Eriksen, because they're sort of the brain of the team, really. Mm. But, you know, didn't he play them both against, wasn't it Brighton? That was the first game of the season when they were kind of, I can't remember if it was Brighton or Brentford, where it was sort of like, yeah, you're going to cleverly interchange positions between being
Eriksen
false nine.
Was a false nine.
Yeah, they were kind of switching, and it just didn't work at all. So, and playing against City, you obviously need someone who can attack the space, which is Rashford. You know, well, this is exactly what Rashford is good at, you know. Of course, Rashford didn't, you know, barely touch the ball. When he did, it wasn't good. You know, he kept giving it away with these sideways balls. You know, it was a real, you know, they were hammered. As Ten Hag said, the question of Ronaldo came up as well. Ronaldo was similar next to Casemiro. Though Casemiro was a more relevant player, you know, in terms of why he wasn't involved than Ronaldo. But Ten Hag said this afterwards when he was asked, you didn't use Ronaldo. I should say, I don't think for a second Ronaldo should have been involved, because you need someone, as I said, who can attack the space. And that's not him anymore. This is what Ten Hag said.
I wouldn't bring him in because we are 4-0 down, out of respect for Cristiano, for his big career. And the other thing, there was then the advantage. I could bring Anthony Martial. He needs the minutes. But I don't want to point it out like that.
Well, I mean, Anthony Martial needs minutes. You know, Ronaldo could do it in a few minutes. He's only playing the World Cup in November.
That's the best answer to that question possible.
Why?
Because, I mean, the truth no one wants to hear, and he doesn't want to say about Ronaldo, which is to say there's literally no role for Ronaldo in this game.
Yeah.
Like, literally none. Like, there's no possible reason to bring Cristiano Ronaldo on at any stage. So, like, yeah. But I mean, it's so obvious to people as well that, like, okay, you ask the question hoping that you get something along the lines of, well, you know, he's no use in this game, and that's a story. So, like, that's how you answer that question.
When is he ever going to be any use, though? I mean, I saw Keane saying they're disrespecting him. I mean, the exact opposite of what Ten Hag is saying. Ten Hag was like, I have too much respect to involve him in that shit show. But Keane was saying they're disrespecting him by just leaving him on the bench, because it's clear, as Keane pointed out, which I think is true, he's not going to get in the team. You know, I mean, if... You know, what circumstances does he actually play? I mean, people have to be injured.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then, well, okay, that could always happen.
There's also the Europa League.
Yeah,
and you know, Ronaldo can run up a few goals. I mean, the disrespect that would have happened was Ronaldo leaving the club and saying, "Well, that was a shit show. I had to get out of there." If anyone had any interest in actually taking them off their hands,
well, Keane says they did, and he's saying that disrespect really is in keeping him, not letting him leave the club, and then sticking him on the bench the whole time. But yeah. he seems to be pretty convinced in his information wherever he's getting.
Yeah.
That there were a bunch of clubs that would have actually taken Ronaldo.
Well, again, you know, it's obviously a situation where United felt that the financial loss was not palatable to them.
But anyway, listen, Ronaldo was such a complete non-issue in the wider scope.
So we
of
shouldn't
this
even
game.
We shouldn't even really be talking about him at this point. I just found that quote kind of funny.
Yeah.
But what else? And also put to Guardiola was something that Florentino Perez had been saying. Perez went talking yesterday. Just his quotes are sort of interesting. So he says, "Our beloved sport is ill, losing global leadership. The young people are increasingly less interested. A trend to reverse before it is too late." That's actually the thing that was put to Guardiola. He says football is sick. You know, we need more games between big teams because young people don't care anymore about the game. They need to come back. And Guardiola just goes, "No comment." So he's... number one, he doesn't want to respond to Florentino Perez and get into what's with,
of course,
with this man, you know, who's a big, powerful figure in Spain. But also because what Perez is saying is sort of targeted at City and PSG. You know, they are his bete noirs, let's say, bete noir. And so what's Perez say? He said, "The new generations prefer other spectacles like the online platforms or video games. They are asking for a quality product that football does not provide because the current competitions do not attract them, even the final phases. With maximum respect to the national leagues, the big European leagues should offer matches throughout the year, matches that bring the young people back. The Super League would not be a close competition." The president of the ECA, that's Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the PSG CEO, president, and lots of other fingers and lots of other UEFA and European football pies. President of the ECA said that Madrid was afraid of the competition. It would be necessary to remind him who Real Madrid is. So basically, you know, we are Real Madrid. Don't ever tell us that we're afraid of competitions. We win competitions. You know, that's what we do. UEFA is increasing the number of games between irrelevant teams. With that, it will only accelerate the decadence of European football. According to Forbes, Madrid is the 13th most valuable club in the world. Before we were fifth, so the 13th most valuable club of all sporting, you know, not just football. There are only three football clubs in that ranking. The trend is inarguable. they must be doing something very well in the United States and very badly in old Europe. La Liga has lost subscribers on TV. Their strategy is to charge more to the few who are left. They've turned a product that should be popular into a luxury product. We've just won the 14th Champions League. We're already thinking about the 15th. He says, Nadal and Djokovic have played against each other 59 times. Is this boring? Real Madrid and Liverpool have met 9 times in 67 years. What is the point in depriving fans of these matches? So, you know, what he's saying here is, you know, obviously he's Mr. Super League. He wants something like this to come back. And he wants basically Real Madrid to be playing Liverpool, for example, more often in order to bring the young people back who he says aren't even attracted to the final stages of the Champions League. There's a problem with this argument. If young people, I mean, first of all, if young people aren't interested in football, because I would be interested to hear where he gets the information on
show your workings.
Yeah, I would be interested to see those figures and to analyze exactly where he's getting this impression from. But if it's take it for a moment as read that, you know, what he's saying has some truth to it. If these young people, these Zoomers, are not interested in watching the final stages of the Champions League. Like if, say, the game between Man City and Real Madrid in the Champions League last season is not capable of attracting them, then they're just not that into it.
Yeah.
They're just not that into it because you can't get more on the line than that. You can't, like City against Madrid, two, you know, top teams, brilliant players on the field. Everything is on the line for the year in this game. And, you know, the two games were this crazy spectacle. If that's not enough.
Yeah, Paris's point is the current thing isn't working. Let's give them more of the current thing.
Pretty much. And it's kind of like, well, I'm not sure. And I think there's a basic sort of misunderstanding, or I don't know if it's deliberate or, but the idea of football as being entertainment is wrong. It's not really entertainment. It's kind of a different thing, right? It's like it's belonging, right? It's a kind of a social phenomenon which is different from like TV shows or like video games, right? It's as entertainment, it actually cannot compete with video games. It's not as good. Like, it's not as good as entertainment. Like you're watching football.
Well, you're a passive observer.
Watching football on TV is basically passive. I mean, you can watch it with other people. It can be social. You can swear together at what's happening. But like, it's still being broadcast at you. You know, a video game, like you're in it. Like that's also social. I mean,
a large part of the popularity of video of gaming at the moment is watching other people game.
Yeah, it's true, but you know, which is incredible. I mean, again, this is, it's not given to us to understand everything that happens.
Yeah, we're past that. We can never understand
the popularity of the of gaming. Isn't just if you're looking for why that's exploded, it can't simply be down to the active role you're playing in it. When actually, passive bystanders find it just as fascinating.
Well, watching, you're also watching for something that you yourself can then play. I mean, football is a bit like that too, but like a lot of people are better at video games than football. It's, you know, you can get better. Not everyone is Erling Haaland, but you know, in virtual form, there are more.
You can be Alfinga Haaland.
You can at least be Alfie, you know. But I just don't feel like people actually watch football really for entertainment. Like do we watch Ireland for entertainment? Like, no.
We watch matches between two teams we don't support in the Premier League, for example, for entertainment.
Do you though? Did you actually watch the Wolves Villa in the end?
Unfortunately.
You were saying it was the worst game ever. Wolves West Ham, sorry, Leeds Villa, another awful game.
Yeah, Wolves, I was unfortunately playing a game myself on Saturday evening, so I didn't.
This is on Francis Murphy's Guide on Friday, you were describing that as the least appealing.
Well, I was just opened it up to the floor for an engaging conversation shut down immediately.
You got your blood sacrifice because Bruno Lage lost his job.
Almost too much entertainment.
But they're literally the two bad games out of a round of fixtures where loads of amazing stuff happened. And of course it was entertaining.
Yeah, no.
Like Liverpool Brighton, that was entertaining to me. I don't support Liverpool or don't support Brighton. But yeah, it's still hilarious and entertaining to watch.
But it's kind of like it's not an entertainment product that can be compared with actual entertainment products like video games, which are also increasingly full of like psychological hooks, like addictive mechanisms, which you know just sorry, but you can't like you football cannot compete with this, and that's not. I just like I kind of see it more like kind of being in a church or. You know, like these types of mass social organizations, which are now in a lot of countries kind of beginning to dissolve a bit, or certainly are nowhere near as, like, you know, unions or political parties or churches.
I'm reading
this
a bit about
this type of a big thing that you are part of or feel yourself to be part of. Because people are watching these games. Take a game of a team that you actually follow. Because most people watching football are watching their team, right? Or trying to follow their team. They're not really that interested in, you know, there might be some people who are like, I'm going to watch six matches or whatever. Most people are kind of paying attention to one team. And is it entertainment they want? There's something else going on there. Like the anger that you feel when you're losing, the kind of the gloating joy of winning, you know, that's a sort of a different thing.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I'm reading a thing about third places at the moment, you know, which is it's kind of why is loneliness such a thing in the 21st century?
Mm.
And it's the absence of a third place, which isn't your home and isn't your work.
Yeah.
And there is certainly an element of football, sports clubs.
Definitely is one of those, is an example of one of those types of places.
Yeah.
And it used to be the church or it used to be the pub or something like this.
Yeah, or cafes, bars, whatever. But it's kind of about urban planning as well. Like urban planning has necessarily taken out third places. So if you live in a suburb in a massive housing estate, there isn't actually a place for you to go and be a part of a community that isn't your home and isn't your work.
Yeah.
And I think that football clubs, sports clubs generally, but football clubs do this as well. They provide a third place for someone to actually exist in the world.
And you know, and that's if you're actually going to the thing, physical space, but as a sort of TV product. I mean, obviously the virtual space is like a third place, you know, in the sense that like there's like this giant universe of social media, which you can sort of be in continually, but like also doesn't do much about atomization or loneliness if you're sitting there looking at a screen by yourself. You know,
that's
you know,
kind of a different. Yeah,
as football as a sort of a thing, I think which is competing for attention in that space is not very well adapted to it compared to some of the things like video games, as he refers to, which have been kind of, which have grown up in that and are designed specifically for it. You know, I don't really.
Is it less that the spectator is passive in real world football and more that the actual organizers, the authorities are basically passive? There's only so much they can do. Like you're saying, they can't actually add all these all these psychological tricks or whatever hooks. Video
loot
game.
Boxes. Yeah. Real Madrid loot box.
Do you know what I mean?
So well, like, actually, Todd Bowley was talking about doing something like that.
Todd Bowley could be the man.
You know, the Chelsea app, you know, we need to start building loyalty points, which they can cash in at the stadium and all this kind of. It's not gambling. You know? although you can also have the gambling version. You know,
well, you could start getting into NFT conversations here as well. Oh, like, I'm not saying these hooks are going to be good things.
Hooks. I mean, is a hook ever a good thing when you're the thing that's meant to get hooked on it? But you know, fundamentally, I think while this is sort of interesting to think about, I think it's also kind of bullshit justifications from Perez for what he wants, which is to say, a new economic setup which would guarantee stable dominance for Real Madrid. I mean, that's actually what he's interested in. He doesn't care if Zoomers aren't watching. Like, you know, not really. Like, but he doesn't want Real Madrid. Like, he's seen Barcelona like burst under the pressure of trying to compete with Qatar. You know, he's seen Barcelona just blow up because you know, if PSG put them in the situation where they have to sort of try. You know, I don't blame PSG entirely for what Barcelona did, which was largely self-authored. But like this kind of raising the stakes with the whole Neymar situation and the kind of incredible salaries Barcelona were paying, they blew up. And now what they've done is they've done like the Liz Truss, quasi-Quarteng, like doubling down. Let's go for it again, you know, levers or whatever. And I mean, I can't say I have great confidence that it's going to end well for them this time, unless there's some kind of change to what Perez is talking about. Anyway, we talked more about Perez really there than we wanted, but what else is going on? Just a couple of other things. I saw Roberto De Zerbi. We were talking about Graeme Souness last week, saying, oh, he obviously went on Google, heard about Brighton. it's hardly the work of a genius. Well, he must have gone on Google again and typed in how to tear Liverpool to pieces, which I actually did just to see, and nothing comes up when you put in that exact
how to tear Liverpool to pieces.
If I put that in a quote marks, your search returned no documents. Mm. So I just then Googled how to beat Liverpool, and the first thing that comes up was actually an article by Michael Cox in The Athletic. So I maybe I'm treading in the footsteps of Roberto De Zerbi. I clicked on this. What was the recipe? This is September 2020. Attack the Liverpool weaker centre back. That was just before.
I'm trying to think, this is probably at a time when they were very strong.
It was the beginning basically of the season when they were champions.
Yeah. So this is probably it's one of those articles being written in that context. Like, it's hard to beat Liverpool. Mm. This is how you do it.
Yeah. They had only lost, you know, they had lost a couple to City and Arsenal. They'd gone this crazy unbeaten run, you know, for a long time. But you know, and this was just before Virgil had his knee crushed by Pickford. So attack the weaker Liverpool centre back, which at the time was,
well, you can have your choice now,
whoever isn't Virgil. Play passes in behind Andy Robertson, wasn't playing of course the other day, because at that time is people talk about Trent, but have you seen the positioning of Robertson? There's often a lot of space there. Press Alisson, you know, he likes to dawdle around with the ball at his feet, maybe run up and try and get the ball off him, so could lead to joy. Exploit the space behind the wide forwards, you know, Salah and Mane. There's often some space behind. Actually, Brighton did do that bit. Beat the XG. Basically, you just score your chances. Score all your chances. And Brighton didn't score all their chances, but they did beat their XG 1.6, and they scored 3 goals. And the build-up to Brighton's third goal was particularly good. This was an example, I think, of what James Horncastle was talking to us about when he mentioned De Zerbi just after he'd been appointed at Brighton, and was saying, you know, De Zerbi obviously having been this figure who was sort of shouting the odds in Italian football and criticising all the old farts with their old-fashioned ways, like, you know, Allegri, people like that, like, you know, obviously much to their annoyance, you know, rattling their cages a bit. Mm. And this whole, they couldn't understand why are you trying to provoke teams to sort of come at you like this. I mean, this is high wire, risk taking stuff. But if you look at what Brighton did for that third goal, and this is and they're losing at that point. I mean, they'd gone from 2-0 up to 3-2 down. It's brilliant. There's like four or five players, around, you know, just inside the Brighton half, passing the ball really quickly to each other. And, you know, Jota and Salah are kind of, what are we going to do? Are we going to sort of stand off, wait for them to? And Brighton don't come forward. So eventually they sort of have to come and try and get the ball. You know, I mean, they decide they have to do that. And it's actually Salah who gets beaten. The second time it happened to him in a very similar way, where he comes to challenge a player who allows the ball to just run past the challenge and then takes it into the space past the challenge. And so he's now beaten, and Brighton are kind of into the midfield sort of structure, you know, where they've been kept on the outside. Now they're in, pass the ball to the outside. And this is when the other thing happens, which is the ball just goes straight through Virgil van Dijk, you know, and then to Trossard, who manages to finish. But like a lot to worry about, really, I think, for Liverpool. I mean, there was an email going on about Trent. Should we mention that? Because Klopp, like last week, actually had sort of, before this game, had spoken about Alexander-Arnold in some detail.
Yeah.
This kind of crisis that he's been going through, and kind of attacking the criticism of him as basically stupid.
Yeah, basically saying, look, this is, I want him to be the first person triggering the press. I want him to be that high up the pitch. That's the reason there's space in behind, because that's literally how I designed the play. He did also allow for the fact that he's made a few individual mistakes defensively at the same time, but he certainly feels that a lot of the stuff is ill-informed, because Trent is just doing what Klopp is asking him to do.
Yeah, and he is, and he did say that, like, I'm asking him to do that. Mm. So, you know, but Gavin Byrne emails us to say, this video of Klopp defending Alexander-Arnold has been retweeted thousands and thousands of times by plenty of Liverpool sympathetic people on the internet. People seem to be celebrating how Klopp has explained to us idiots that Alexander-Arnold's high position was by design, a function of the way the team presses, blah, blah, blah. I think this is a complete misrepresentation of the criticism Alexander-Arnold has been getting, though. I don't think anyone anywhere in their right mind was criticizing him for instances where he's caught high up the pitch. Anyone can see this is a deliberate tactic. He's been getting criticized for poor defending when he's been in defensive positions, has been repeatedly beaten by wingers and shown little to no intensity or interest in winning the ball back. His one-on-one defending has actually regressed. As Liverpool attack has stuttered a bit this season, the attacking output hasn't been the same. Both sides of the risk and reward equation have shifted with greater risk and less reward. So, yeah, I mean, again, you know, there were mistakes for both of the first two Brighton goals. And, you know, he nearly managed to score a free kick at the end. Didn't, though. And really is going through a bit of a nightmare at the moment. I mean, it's got to the point where I think, would it be good for him to not have to go to the World Cup? I mean, because, you know, whether he goes or not, he's probably not going to play much, barring a bunch of injuries. So is it better to go and be part of it or to stay at home and just kind of reset your...
If he's not... you're looking into a crystal ball there and assuming there won't be injuries, and therefore it probably is. But to be honest, in a way, I don't see the point in Southgate bringing him, because he's the exactly... What Klopp talks about there is all the stuff that Southgate doesn't want to do tactically. Yeah.
So no matter, he's already made clear his feelings on Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah, you get into a situation where you lose a couple of fullbacks and suddenly you're thrown.
Yeah, I've got no problem playing
you and
Alexander-Arnold.
And even the teammates know that you don't want him to do what he normally does. So it could be better for all concerned, maybe, for Alexander-Arnold to stay home.
Yeah, now there's a couple of other things here. Obviously, the early game, I mean, it always sort of gets a bit lost when we do these on Mondays, but it was a big game, Arsenal against Tottenham, and Arsenal are still top of the league as a result of their 3-1 win and a good win in keeping with their good home record against Spurs recently. I thought they were a bit lucky that Spurs played so badly because, and I see a lot of the reaction to this is kind of, there's, you know, sort of questions over Conte's approach and whether it's too limiting, like it's too reactive, or, you know, there's not enough freedom, not enough creativity. But I still feel as though, I mean, watching the game, I couldn't believe Tottenham weren't winning it at halftime. They butchered so many of these chances that you're just expecting, especially with a player like Son. You know, and again, remember Son. Well, Son just scored a hat trick. Remember having been through this awful period where he couldn't seem to do anything right. He then came on as a sub, scored a hat. It was a hat trick, right?
I am finding it hard to remember what happened before.
He scored the goal of the month. He scored one of them was the goal of the month.
He scored a hat trick.
It was a hat trick.
As
a sub,
17 minutes or whatever it was. Yeah.
And so it's like, he's back, you know, Son is back. But then, of course, it's kind of this long break and everyone has sort of forgotten where they were. And he's just kind of, again, this performance is one of the worst performances I've seen from him in terms of the sloppiness of his passing when he's involved in counterattacks, and he's usually lethal, you know? So something is kind of weird there. He's been so reliable for so long that this is just a massive drop off. And I don't really understand what it is, I don't know obviously they've signed, you know, Richarlison and Kulusevski. He's playing very well with Kulusevski, you know, in the squad last season. Is he feeling threatened, like in terms of, like Jota, his form sort of fell off a cliff a bit when Liverpool signed Diaz, because it was suddenly a case of, hang on, do I still have a role here? You know, I don't know if something like that is happening with Song. I'm just grasping for whatever it might be.
Good day out for Arsenal, though.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Granit Xhaka having his name sung.
And Xhaka, it is an amazing turnaround. He's one of the guys who comes across well in that documentary, actually, Xhaka. Like, he's got a good personality. You know, I mean, I say he's got a good personality. I still remember last season where he came out with this ridiculous tirade about the team towards the end of the season. Remember, he kind of was like attacking the team. I was like, why are you saying this? It's not your job to do that. Like, there's plenty of people who'll do that for you. You know, you don't need to come in public and say this. But, you know, rather than it sort of, I don't think people lose respect for him because he fundamentally seems to be quite a kind of likable guy, you know, that his teammates kind of like him, you know, and so they're like, well, he's, you know, every so often he's going to just go out and say we're the worst team in the world.
The Arsenal fans.
But, you know.
Finally like him after all these years.
Coach Marsh was pissed off again, not for the first time, about time wasting.
Just pissed. by the way.
Pissed, of course. He was he was pissed.
The American terminology. Yeah.
He was pissed. Stevie G's Villa came and just absolutely acted the maggot and you know, just wasted time the whole time. Two to three opponents we've had here, says Jesse Marsh, thinking of obviously Frank Lampard's Everton as well, who are level on points with Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. Should just point that out. Two to three opponents we've had who just want to throw the ball away. Take a minute on every goal kick. We need to help manage this. We can't do it alone. Our fans don't come here to watch a snail's pace match. So
he thinks it's entertainment.
Well, it's yeah, well, I mean, I guess so. I mean, he's American. But he is. It's
unbelievable.
It's not okay. That what I just did there is not okay.
Yeah, it's, can I just say, I'd like to distance myself from
that comment.
It's
not okay. I distance myself from my own comment. I don't even know where that came from. You know, probably just crawling around in
Ken Corla, I would like to apologize for my
slimy undergrowth of the internet.
Yeah.
That was terrible. But, you know, and it sounds like he might be an advocate of the, you know, the 60-minute basic time, universal basic time concept, you know, which David Dean, for instance, is pushing. So you've got like a 60-minute, you have to have 60 minutes of in-play time. 30 minutes of each half, which doesn't mean that the game is now 30 minutes. It means you've still got
120 minutes.
You've still got a 90-minute game.
Yeah.
But the game will continue until such time as 30 minutes of each in-play time has actually expired in each half, right? Rather than the current, we'll add on however much we think is good for the narrative, you know? like there was 2 minutes in the game yesterday. It's like, well, you know. Let's just wrap this one up. Yeah. The 6-3, but
just as United were charging as well,
they really were. You know, maybe that was it. It was like, look, you know,
we never lose. We just run out of time. Says Eric Ten Hag.
Let's blow that one up. But I do wonder what the effect of that actually would be. Would it have unintended bad effects? Like, obviously, the idea is there's no point in time wasting anymore because you can't waste the time. The ball being out of play, the clock stopped. Mm. So you can waste as much time as you like, but you haven't wasted any time. I just wonder if the thing is that the incentive then, or the advantage is then with the team that doesn't want the time to run out, who can then take their time in a way that hasn't. I think about Rafael Nadal playing tennis. Mm-hmm. I find him annoying to watch.
With his big routine before each serve.
Every single point, Rafael Nadal wipes his eyebrows, adjusts his shirt and shorts, mm-hmm. bounces the ball a few times, and sometimes does it all over again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're just like, come on, I don't have all day.
The idea is that time-wasting isn't just about wasting time. It's also about breaking momentum. And in Dean's idea, then momentum-breaking can go on and not be punished at all.
It can do. I know, but also you can sort of be, you can sort of take little breathers. Mm. You know, a team that's like chasing the game.
I've watched a rugby game recently.
Chasing
the result. If ball's in play for 3 minutes, everyone just takes a break. The water carriers just bomb on. Everyone just has a break. It's like, what are we doing? Lads,
I thought we were meant to be hurrying the game up. Yeah, so I'm not sure how it would work. I mean, it would be interesting. So anyway, just a couple of other things. First win for Graham Potter at Chelsea. League win, I guess. Great goal by Conor Gallagher.
First win. They drew their only game, Champions League game.
First win. So good. Good to get going. And that they've signed also, or are signing, Nkunku from Red Bull Leipzig. Now, he's not going to be arriving until next summer. But they've done a kind of a Naby Keita-style arrangement, I guess, where they pay a little bit above the buyout clause in order to secure the signing. This is reported by David Ornstein. And he writes, so Christopher Nkunku is going to be a Chelsea player, which is an interesting one. As a forward, he is different from what they have had. He is a proper centre forward. He's not the biggest. He's not the fastest. But he is a very good all-rounder who works very hard for the team. I would say the player he kind of reminds me of is Gabriel Jesus.
Because they have Aubameyang. I mean, they literally just signed Aubameyang. He scored at the weekend.
I mean, that was a mistake. They should never have signed Aubameyang.
It's a good goal at the weekend.
He scored a goal, and he is capable of scoring goals, but like, he's not really a centre forward. He doesn't have the kind of physical dynamism. Forward. I don't think he is. No. I don't think he's a striker. He's like a goal poaching forward. He's not really going to I don't think he can lead the line for a team in the Premier League at this point. I mean, I'm sure we're going to see him doing that for Chelsea because they don't really have other options. I mean, Havertz is kind of maybe a false nine option, but this guy, Nkunku, is better able, is physically up to the demands of that. I mean, whether he's good as good a goal scorer as Aubameyang, I don't think so. Certainly hasn't shown that yet. But as an all-round sort of a package, I think that he is more suitable for what they're doing and can, you know. The thing about Aubameyang is I don't really feel that he helps the players around him to look good as well. But I think that Nkunku can do that. So it's a good signing for Chelsea, I think, although obviously nothing is going to change until next summer.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's a beautiful summer's day. The breeze is stupendous.
Stupendous. Stupendous.
Would this podcast be even more stupendous without ads?
Without ads?
Ads. If so, then join us for daily commercial-free shows at secondcaptains.com for just €5 a month.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not bumping them up. I'm not Irish. I'm just saying my observations, they are amazing.
Stupendous.
Some Manchester Derby chat now with John Bruin. Hi, John.
Hello, Owen.
And Mark Critchley, who was at the Etihad for the Independent. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Hey, how's it going?
Nice, easy question for you to start with, Mark. How is Erling Haaland making this look so bloody easy?
I don't know. Like, with it's the first week of October, and even talking to colleagues and everyone else who covers Manchester football, we're running out of things to say. Even Pep's running out of things to say. You know, it just feels like, how have we reached this point already? We've still got 9 months of the season to go talking about how good this guy is. I mean, you're running out of words to describe him. I mean, even the words that people use to describe him are kind of insults, like alien, freak. It's like
monster. Wenger called him a monster.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that sort of thing. Like, you just, it almost like inverts the definition of language to try and find new ways of saying how good he is. I just think all you can do really is just look at the numbers that he's just accruing and the records that he's breaking. And, you know, it's as many Premier League hat tricks as Ronaldo now, and I think 224 fewer games. I think he's set to break the Premier League record for goals in a season's 34. I think he can do that in the next 12 games at this rate. And, you know, he's scoring, I think there was a graphic yesterday, he's scoring every, like, 14 touches. It's just something that we've never really seen before. A paradigm is being shifted, if you like, in how we judge and how history judges, and certainly Premier League history judges strikers. And yeah, look, I think it's the economy of it. I think that's, you know, there was in Pep's press conference after the game yesterday, he said that he was speaking to Haaland, and he said that he'd like to touch the ball 5 times in a game and score 5 goals, and that he doesn't like that and he wants him to touch the ball more. But I had a look at it afterwards. I had a look at, like, the numbers in terms of his touches and things like that. He's actually taking fewer touches at City than he did at Dortmund even last season. So you're actually seeing an even more kind of pared back version of the player that we all thought was kind of almost what a lot of people said, and there was reason to the logic that he wasn't a natural fit for this City team in that sense. But it's what he does with those touches when he gets it. And, you know, it's just extraordinary. I mean, in the press box yesterday, we were sat just a few yards behind Alfie Haaland. And I think, you know, it was tweeted around quite a lot that after he scored his hat-trick, he joined in the whole Poznan that was going around the stadium. And you were looking at this guy, like, facing you, turning back at you. And you were thinking, you were like a jobbing, workman-like midfielder who was known for kicking people and getting kicked, you know, more than anything else. And yet, I was just trying to get into his head and thinking, like, what must it be like for you witnessing this and just thinking you've created this monster, you know, this guy who makes elite professional football look just like child's play. And it's just extraordinary. It is really. And like I say, I don't know how I'm going to keep writing about him between now and May and beyond that, because you're running out of ways to describe just what he's doing.
Well, to give Alf Inge his due, he still holds the record. He's still got 4 goals more than Erling has for Manchester City in the Premier League. So Haaland will have that wrapped up next weekend, no doubt, the way he's going at the moment. John, I have to say, I know I take Mark's point about the economy with which he does everything, but I did feel yesterday was maybe his best all-round performance. I mean, he set up a couple of goals right from the start. He got on the ball and he got hacked down in the first minute, as did Grealish a little while later. I thought he looked like, not that he's never not in the mood, but he was very much in the mood. And I don't know, I thought it was probably his best all-round performance for City. Like, it was ridiculous. He showed he can actually pass like Kevin De Bruyne when he was put in the position to do so.
Yeah, it was almost like, okay, I'm going to show how good I can be with the economy that Mark mentions. So however few touches of the ball he had, he managed to show that he can be both unbelievable goal scorer and playmaker too. I don't know if he, in Irish sports, I don't know if you've ever had this equivalent of a paradigm shift player. You know, in, say, rugby union, you had, say, Dan Carter or Jonah Lomu, someone like that. Cricket, you have a Donald Bradman, I suppose, would be with the guy, maybe motor racing, you know, Michael Schumacher. Somebody, and obviously golf, Tiger Woods. Somebody that just completely...
Jack McCaffrey? No? Who would it be in the...
It would be Stephen Cluxton, probably the Dublin goalkeeper, I would say. Okay. As somebody who actually... Are you talking about somebody who's given credit for changing the game or changing the way his position...
But just being played, so good at something you listen to the great football men like Graham Souness or Roy Keane. They'll always talk about how, maybe not so much Roy, but the hardest part of playing the game is, you know, is scoring goals and being a striker. Yet Haaland appears to make that look incredibly easy, and his smashing statistics, and you're almost going back into the Wilsonian era, the Jonathan Wilson era of like Dixie Dean or something, and beginning to think, you know, when we used to laugh about, oh, the defences back in the 1920s, they can't be much cop. Well, Erling Haaland is making them, now making us realise what that might have been like.
He's got to smash Dixie Dean's 60 goals.
Never heard 60 goals.
Yeah. He's never heard of Dixie Dean, no?
Really?
He revealed to Gary Neville when Gary Neville asked him about Dixie Dean. He's, have you ever heard of him? No. But
so he's never heard of... So does that mean he's never heard of George Camsell that scored 59 the season before Dixie Dean scored 60?
I had never heard of that guy. Yeah. I mean, it's 59 is no use to anyone when the next guy scores 60.
He scored 59 one season, and the next season the guy scores 60. That's a joker, that is, isn't it? But yes, look him up, very interesting. But you are looking at a player that's doing this, and then, as you introduced me there, I mean, he does that, and now we're seeing this other side of him where he does have the talent to play in players, to involve himself in combination play, and that, you know, you've got Phil Foden there.
Oh yeah, listen, we're going to talk about him, but we're not finished talking about the freak, the alien, the monster.
But I mean, just in comparison, Phil Foden is probably the most talented English player we've seen for quite a long time.
Is Phil Foden better than David Silva?
Yes.
Yeah, he obviously is, right, Mark?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Why?
Look, he's not achieved what David Silva has yet.
Imagine David Silva, but scores goals.
Let's end it over a concerted period of time.
Okay, look, here's a question that sort of arose watching Haaland. It's like unbelievable. Now, part of it, okay, is obviously, and when Haaland did that interview with Neville, and when Guardiola talks about him, Guardiola always says, well, he's got good mates, his mates around him. This is the word Guardiola uses for his players. And the brilliant passing of Kevin De Bruyne, you know, I mean, the pass for the third City goal, you know, the one that Haaland second, I mean, just incredible. Kevin De Bruyne's been doing that for 7 years, by the way. And yeah. There's no one, and he's played with some pretty useful strikers or forwards, and no one has come close to this, you know, this sort of efficiency or this. I mean, efficiency is efficient, but it's kind of more spectacular than the word efficiency suggests. You know, it's absurd what he's doing. No one has been able to do this before. Is Guardiola now in the dock for wasting the last 7 years? For wasting 7 years of Kevin De Bruyne by failing to provide the best assister in the world with the kind of big number nine he's been crying out for all along. I mean, if Guardiola hadn't been so obsessed with his own theories about the 11 midfielder game, could he be sitting atop a mountain of Champions Leagues now if he had simply just gone and bought a big lad? Football, Pep, is fundamentally a game of big number nines, and is mine bigger than yours? And that's what Erling Haaland has proved. It's sort of proving his manager wrong. I mean, what do you make of that?
I think that if we're talking about Erling Haaland being this paradigm shift player and somebody that hasn't been around before, then what was he supposed to? There wasn't this kind of number nine. No, it's not just any number nine. He had a pretty good number nine in Sergio Aguero for years and years, and look, that was still enough to win multiple Premier League titles and with record points totals. But again, what we're seeing now is something completely beyond that level, you know. And I know you've been slightly facetious with the question, so, but I wouldn't obviously say that Pep's failed in any way to do that. I the third goal that you talk about yesterday, Haaland's second, I was sat right behind that in the press box. And looking at it as De Bruyne tried to play the pass, it felt like that isn't a pass that comes off.
Absolutely, that's exactly what I thought watching it. And I think the crowd didn't react to it until the ball hit the net because they couldn't see how it was going to be a goal from, you know, it just didn't look like a goal was coming there.
Precisely, yeah. And it's not even the fact that there was about four United players in front of him or defenders around him. It's also even Haaland's position in at the far post. He's so close to the byline there that the pass only needs to be slightly off for it to go out of play, or the finish just needs to be wrong. And it's almost the combination of the two. It just means that this City team, I mean, I always thought that the 17-18 team was the best one, and I've maintained that for years. And, you know, this one's still got a whole, you know, 8 months or whatever to play. But it's like this one's playing on a whole new conception of geometry, or like, it is like 4D chess, you know, it is like they're acting on a kind of plane that defenders just aren't used to actually having to think about or defend against. And that was what that goal felt like yesterday, when you have the combination of De Bruyne's vision and ability to get the ball into that space, and but also Haaland's just, you know, just the fact that he can stretch that left leg out and reach it. It's like nothing that any opponents have really had to compute before. And that's why I think that we're just talking about something completely different that, you know, other Guardiola teams couldn't really have emulated, because they didn't have a player like Haaland to do that, even if they did have De Bruyne at the same time.
Yeah. And I think also another thing about that game yesterday that should be pointed out is that it actually was an understrength City team, you know, hugely understrength. I mean, Rodri is like their main man in midfield. I mean, he kind of usually dictates the tempo of the whole game. I mean, obviously, Gundogan is a pretty decent player to bring into that role. But you know, that was they were missing a big player there. They were playing their fourth and fifth choice centre backs, I guess, you know, because of injuries to Diaz, Laporte and Stones. And you know, when I saw the teams at the beginning of the game, I have to admit, I thought, well, I think United have got a good chance here, because you know, you've already seen them against Liverpool and Arsenal, the way that they were able to win those matches, and I thought that could well happen again. Obviously, after about 3 minutes, I was beginning to form a different idea about the game.
It's like about 90 seconds.
Actually, I'm not sure if United are going to. I do have a chance here. But John, I just wanted to ask about the what you feel the impact of this is on Manchester United, because you have, you know, you've been around the block a couple of times, John. You've been there at the low points for Manchester United. You've seen you know, the Barbarians sack the Citadel a few times. 5-1 in 1989, 6-1 memorably again in 2011, and a bunch of other, you know, I mean, these defeats. What I want to ask is, did the impact of this feel, how would you compare this sort of emotional impact on Manchester United of what happened to them yesterday, which was an absolute, like, I think yesterday was a more thorough defeat than either of those, the ones that I mentioned, the 5-1 or the 6-1. The 6-1, I remember City ran in three goals late on, you know, as United were chasing the game. This one was already 6-1 when they decided, okay, we're going to take off four of our best players now and sort of just play this one out. So the scoreline looks better. But in my opinion, the thrashing was more comprehensive. Like the superiority was, what the gap between the sides was bigger. And yet it felt to me as though United were kind of like, yeah, you know, this is just one of those days, you know, as opposed to like a 1,000-year earthquake, you know, of the style of the, say, the 5-1 and 89. This just kind of felt, I mean, I don't know if you shared that impression.
Yeah. Weirdly, I remember listening to the 5-1 in the back of a taxi back in 1989. The 6-1, if I'm correct, United were down to 10 men, and as you say, Ken, chasing the game. But yeah, in neither of those games did Manchester City declare, to use a cricketing term, which is pretty much what they did here. And it did get to the point where Martin Tyler, amongst his discourse, of which there was plenty, we started to talk about another game that Manchester City played in the 80s when they beat Huddersfield 10-1, which yeah. I do remember.
He starts talking about there being three hat-trick scorers in that game, yeah. And you're thinking, oh, well.
Well, yeah, let me see if I can remember them. The hat-trick scorers, Paul Stewart, David White, and Tony Adcock, who was a lesser-spotted flame-haired striker. And I believe, if I can remember this, Neil McNabb got the other goal for City, and it was a penalty. I think was it either Eddie or Andy May. I think it's Andy May, who'd been a City player. Malcolm McDonald was the manager at Huddersfield. So we were almost like rolling into history. And this is when City were in the second division, as was, and it was that level of punishment that was being dished out at that point until City just decided, okay, you know, rest players. They've obviously got Champions League assignments to cope with. There's a long season ahead. Pep Guardiola, I suspect, doesn't want to be too showy too early. He knows what could happen to his team towards the end of the season. As regards Manchester United, the game that it actually reminded me of was early in the David Moyes era, when Manuel Pellegrini was City manager. They went to the Etihad. I think they lost 4-1, absolutely punished, battered out of sight. And you saw the huge gulf between City and United then. And the thing is, that's 2013. We're in 2022 now. The gulf is just as large now. That's what we saw yesterday, Sunday. United have had a decent start to the season after that. Those couple of defeats at the start. They've beaten Liverpool and Arsenal. And I suppose the thing that we could take from it is the gulf between Manchester City and everybody else in those big games could be absolutely huge. No one has those gears that they have. United were caught cold from, you said, I think you did, you say the third minute, Ken?
Well, I
thought that was a bit late. I mean, I thought they were caught cold from.
Well, there was, you know, City sort of got in and there was like three, Haaland had the header and then it came out to De Bruyne and it was a block and then it came out.
Yes, that's right.
And someone else, Grealish or Silva, had another shot and it was blocked again. And you, well, it's one of those.
Well, a lot of half chances already.
As soon as that, I thought, well, hang on a sec. And you, at that point, you think, are United going to just soak up pressure and score goals on the counter as they did against Arsenal? Well, no, is the answer, because Manchester City are a completely different proposition. And actually, at the end of it, who I felt most sorry for was Arsenal, who were having a really good season, really enjoying themselves. Hope springs eternal. And yet, they can't win the league with that Manchester City team around. It's never going to happen, is it?
Yeah, I did think the pre-match analysis was a little bit, like, a lot of the optimism around Manchester United seemed to centre around the fact that, well, they're better against better teams, that it suits them better to play against the likes of Man City, Mark. The problem being that Man City aren't Arsenal. You know what I mean? In fact, with due respect to Liverpool, Man City are a lot better than Liverpool this season as well. It seemed a bit of a flimsy argument to me, just basically because they can play on the counter-attack potentially, and therefore they can beat this team that are way better than them, which obviously didn't pan out that way. I mean, what did you make of Ten Hag afterwards? He's talking about belief. We didn't have enough belief to do it, and I let the players know that they weren't brave enough and all these sorts of things. What did Man United get wrong?
Look, I think as we kind of discussed after the Arsenal game, I think Ten Hag, after those opening two defeats, he has lent into this identity that you identify there about how they're still thought of as a good counter-attacking team who are useful out of possession and have the players to hit teams on the break. And I do still think that's the point, that's where they're at the moment. And so it wasn't really much of a surprise to see them follow that same game plan, but it was just how rushed it was. You know, the number of like simple passes that were being misplaced in that opening kind of 20 minutes when they were still 1-0 down, and they still had a kind of route to get back into the game. I mean, it was stunning, really. And those first 20 minutes, Foden and Grealish were absolutely all over them. And both their fullbacks, both Malacia and Dalot, got on the book in quickly, pretty early. And you just felt they're not being protected whatsoever. I saw Flip with Wenger discussing this afterwards as well. And you just thought they're not being protected because Ten Hag wants his forwards all the way up the field to release that counter-attack. And it just felt like, you know, if they'd just been a little bit more patient at times, they just tried to carry a little bit more possession, then maybe they could have got themselves something of a foothold into the game, but it got completely taken away from them through that. And look, he was talking about belief. He was talking about attitude and things like that. I think he was saying similar things after the Brentford game. And I think this feels very different from the Brentford game, because not just because they've had that bounce, but because it was almost to be expected, you know, just given the side that City are, this is given the side that United are. But I mean, again, like I think just as you, after the Arsenal game, we were kind of reluctant to take these four wins as a turning point. You've got to also just be careful that the magnitude of the result yesterday doesn't wipe out all the kind of little baby steps that they've been taking over the past like month or so. Ten Hag doesn't tend to change winning teams, and this was one thing he mentioned. That he was asked afterwards, basically, why didn't you play Casemiro? And yeah, I think that's one thing that you'll probably see, that we probably should see over the next few weeks now. Yeah. He doesn't tend to change his winning teams. He believes in rhythm. He wants a process to be maintained.
Yeah, I know what you mean, right? I saw him saying that, and I thought, yeah, that's fair enough. And there's an argument about, like, I mean, if we talk about United's approach to the game, and basically it was the same approach as it was against Liverpool and Arsenal, and almost the same team as played in both of those games. It was the same team that played against Arsenal. And, you know, I can see why he does that. But maybe he needed to sort of assess that a bit more realistically in terms of what they were going to be coming up against, and ask if all those attacking players could really fit in. And then he's got Casemiro sitting there. Now, I know you say you don't want to change a winning team, but he's happy enough to change a winning team when he was taking Anthony Elanga out to put Anthony. Yeah. In his massive new signing. Elanga played against Liverpool. They won that game. That's where they kickstarted the season, you could say. But by the time they played Arsenal, they had Antony and he was playing. Now, Casemiro is a huge signing. And if that's not a game for Casemiro, I'm sort of like, you're playing away at City. You've got like this massively, you know, the most successful defensive midfielder in European football of the last however many years. And you leave him on the bench. That was a weird decision.
I agree. I think two things on that. I think, so yes, the Elanga and Antony thing, I agree. Yeah, he said that he won't change a winning team, and yet he did that straight away. I think you have to factor in there was injuries there. Elanga didn't play too well in the game against Leicester just before that either. So his options were a bit more limited there, where he thinks McTominay, and quite a lot of people have been quite giving a lot of praise to McTominay for his performances recently. So maybe that's more of a question of individual form. But also, I think, I think your question touches on a point which yeah, Casemiro is not Ten Hag's ideal holding midfielder. And, you know, if anyone wants to dispute that, we only have to look at the fact that they were chasing Frankie de Jong or some for evidence that that is the case. You know, he was signed because of the frustration over the de Jong deal that they couldn't get there. Not that he wasn't, not that he isn't a world-class holding midfielder, like you say, the best in Europe over the last few years. But he was not the number one priority there. And I think that is also informing Ten Hag's decisions recently of late as well. That's why I say when it feels like it's the obvious choice for him now to come into the team, but we'll see how it shakes out, because we don't really know what Ten Hag's kind of vision or how he sees this team developing yet. I think, like I say, he's wanted to keep that winning team together because, let's face it, what you saw at Brentford was such an absence of any kind of attitude or any kind of work ethic or any kind of team spirit, that to try and maintain that, he probably saw a benefit to that. But yeah, look, Casemiro needs to come into the side sooner or later. Otherwise, why have you spent 60, rising to £70 million on him for a player of his calibre? He's the type of player that United have needed for years now when they've been playing the likes of McTominay in there. And it should only really be a matter of time before he comes into the side. And you'd hope that's the next step in whatever process that Ten Hag is now following to develop this team.
John, word on Liverpool, who were so defensively poor. So they conceded six big chances against Brighton. So according to Opta, basically every Brighton chance was a big chance. And it's not really hard to see why, but why is it that they're, as in why they were considered big chances? I mean, this was incredibly open by Liverpool. Klopp talks every week now about how confidence is a flower and the flower has been trampled and all these sorts of things, which I kind of find...
It's not much use, really, is it?
You're
relying on a flower. Relying on a flower which could get trampled at any moment. I mean, there wasn't much talk of this over the last few years.
What's going on there, John?
Yeah, from heavy metal to flowers. Oh, dear. We could have had another... As you say, you could have had another 6-3 on the weekend's football, and it would have been deserved. Brighton were the better team, the more threatening team. I think it's fair to say the secret is out that Liverpool are no longer very good at defending or very good at protecting the defence. Virgil van Dijk, was it that players thought that van Dijk was so good so there wasn't actually any point going near them because they get the ball taken off them? But now I've gained the confidence thinking if the ball goes into Van Dijk's area, we've got a chance. Is it something like that? Because he really has dropped off a cliff. Mm. As much as Trent Alexander-Arnold has taken the brunt of the criticism for Liverpool's defending. But actually, who should bear the criticism for Liverpool's defending? You do have to go to the manager, don't you, really? And question what's gone wrong there. Jürgen himself looks worried. He looks that the suntan with which he which I saw them at Fulham first day of the season, that's faded a little bit.
You're saying he needs to get in the sunbed.
I'm saying that Jürgen's sort of summary, I suppose, sense of optimism already seems to have extinguished. He looks a little grey around the gills. He looks worried by what's going on, and rightly so. I mean, you've discussed it on this program, I know, the undercurrent over the Darwin Nunez and stuff like that.
Undercurrent?
Yes.
I mean, is there such thing as an overcurrent? I mean,
the Nunez thing is in, okay.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, he doesn't sort of think Nunez is
any good.
He doesn't want to put him in the team.
But is that the main problem? Obviously not at the weekend.
Well, I think it's definitely a problem. Like, if you say, take the example of what's happening at City at the moment, where Haaland is just like this, you know, just destroying everyone and everything. And it's like, this guy, you know, imagine the confidence that gives everybody else. It's sort of, you know, in a game you can sort of play not even that well. Like, say at Wolves, they beat Wolves 3-0. Just, you know, a couple of ages ago, it seems like they didn't actually play that well in that game. But like Haaland just scores this goal. Remember the goal he scored in that, like a right foot? Like maybe he scored it. He probably scored again. I can't remember. But he scored that right footer from outside the area. And you're just like, well, this is just, you know. Whereas at Liverpool, not only has their main man, Salah, just stopped scoring. You know, he looks like one of these players who's like, oh, he looks like, what was the name of that guy who scored 59 goals, John?
George
Camsell. George Camsell. No one remembers. He looks like, oh no, I'm going to be George Camsell now. You know, like he's being eaten up by the, you know, my record is going to be gone by Christmas. You know, I won't even be at the World Cup. You know, and then the guy who they brought in to be, well, I mean, he at the time was sort of like their parallel signing. Oh, they've both gone for number 9. It's just been a complete disaster. You know, I mean, obviously the red card happened, but every time he's played, he's looked absolutely awful.
Mark, do you want to come in on any of this?
I watched the Ajax game in the Champions League a few weeks ago, and Nunes is kind of his level of composure and what he does. He feels like every touch that he takes is a shot, and it's almost like with you could say that of Haaland as well, but these aren't the right shots, you know. Whereas Haaland's doing it in situations where you're like, oh my God, that's a goal, obviously. It feels like Nunes is just desperate to impress and really isn't at the moment.
By what you're saying there, do you feel as though he can't really be this bad? Or it's just, wow, they really have signed a turkey to end all turkeys?
No, it's still really early, I think. And he obviously played really well for Benfica last season. But if you go on his kind of historical performance and stuff like that, last season was a bit of a flash in the pan and really came out of nowhere. So the bet that Liverpool have made is on that being repeated, whereas the bet that City have made is on arguably the best generational talent, certainly a centre forward that we've seen. Well, yeah, that we've seen in a generation. So Liverpool's kind of resources mean that they do have to take those kind of bets and they do have to make that play. But I'm not exactly optimistic about it at the minute. I just put it like that.
Poor old Darwin Nunes plays 1 minute plus injury time of the weekend's game. Well,
why does he play 1 minute? Yeah. You know, was he only available for 1 minute? He's available for 90, but they decided to use him for one. So what does that tell you?
John, just before you go, I'll be kicking myself if I don't. The paradigm shift Irish sports person, it's Katie Taylor, for crying out loud. She basically invented her sport as a mainstream sport in Ireland anyway, then got it into the Olympics, won an Olympic gold medal, is doing similar stuff in the professional games. I'd be kicking myself if I let that one slide without mentioning Katie. So listen, great stuff, John. Thanks so much. Mark, brilliant. Thanks a million.
Cheers.
A flame hair, Mr. Ken Early.
Every so often, I'm on the bus and I suddenly turn around and bite somebody. John Hayes, I'm talking about, aren't you? John Hayes. Now, I always thought that was ridiculous.
He had won the victory over himself. He loved Brendan Rodgers.
That's where it comes from. Thanks a lot, Pepe.
Fair to say, anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not. Let me show you right now before you give it up.
That audio bed is especially for Tony Adcock, the flame-haired flamethrower of goals for Huddersfield, as mentioned by John Bruno. Just on
for Man City, of course.
Adcock,
he scored a hat-trick for Man City.
Oh, against Huddersfield, I should say.
Against Huddersfield.
Sorry, yeah. Just on the Erling versus Alf Inge goal chase after scoring a couple of goals on his debut in early August. I boldly predicted Erling Haaland could catch his Outlads total of 18 goals before the September international break.
Ah, okay. Because I was wondering.
Nah. The postponement of a round of fixtures put paid to that. But after moving up to 14 in 8 matches, would you bet against him scoring 4 next week against Southampton? It would be more bad news for Gavin Bazunu. Bazunu's had a tough time recently. We got an email in, actually. So he conceded 2 goals in 2 minutes against Everton. For those maybe listeners who weren't watching the Irish national team, he conceded a couple of goals against Armenia, at least one of which he should not have conceded. Murph is pinning the blame for both goals.
I stand by my contention on
his gloves. But in this case, Dwight McNeil scored one at the near post. That's like one of those. He lashed it in really hard from really close range. But I actually think the first goal, the Conor Cody goal, there's a big high ball looped in for one of the Everton players to head down.
Should you come for it?
I think you have to come for it. It's around the 6-yard box.
it's, as Roy Keane might say, where's my goalkeeper there, you know?
Well, he hates goalkeepers, as
but
we know.
The email from Mark Staines here, anyway, is talking about the fanfare around Gavin Bazunu. And now, before I get hammered for this, Bazunu is a good goalkeeper. He's young, he's playing in the Premier League and so on. However, we have to call it as we see it. I don't think that's happening right now, except for Murph, maybe. In my mind, I'm left ever so slightly less impressed by the appearance of Bazunu the more games tick by. One big issue I have is how small he seems to be for a top-level goalkeeper at a paltry 6 feet 2 inches. To us mere mortals, he's a huge man. However, this lack of height must have an impact on what seems like a real inability to save shots from distance as a Liverpool fan. Blah, blah. He basically says Keller is not amazing either. In short, I believe Bazunu is going to continue to struggle with long shots and crosses, and I think second captains shouldn't be afraid to talk about it. All my love, says Mark in Kildare.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for the support. I know it's lonely up here sometimes, but, you know, listen, that's my job. That's what I signed up for.
I don't know if he is 6 foot two. 6 foot two seems adequate for a Premier League.
Six, I think
six foot two is an average height for a goalkeeper.
But then he didn't come. Yeah, like I'm saying, he didn't come and attack the cross. Attack that.
He's tall. He's taller than Lloris by 1 centimeter. He is taller than Ederson by 1 centimeter. He's taller than Pickford, who obviously has come up in this.
So you're saying height is not an issue, but we may still have a Bazunu problem, or not? Just some of the early Bazunu glosses may be being wiped off slowly.
I wouldn't be as quick as you to criticize him for the Onana header that leads to Cody's goal.
Oh, we're
goal.
Going the other way around. From
yeah, just because I feel like it's the far side of the six-yard box. I mean, it's Onana is not heading it from, like, between the two goalposts.
You know, Owen, I agree with Murphy here. I don't think it was... I think it was just on the outside of where he should come from. I mean, I was wondering the same thing about De Gea on the Haaland goal. Like, De Gea does have a habit of watching crosses come into the box and staring at it.
David De Gea and his goal line is the great love affair of English football.
I can't quit you. but maybe he should come. But then I watched it again. I was like, well, the way the ball comes in, from where Haaland heads it, it looks like maybe De Gea should be going for that. But the way the ball has come in from high and sort of curling in, it's like if he comes for that, he's going to miss that.
Yeah.
And the Bazunu one isn't a comfortable catch or anything, but it's one you could, you're the goalkeeper, get up there, try and punch it away. If you get touched, it's going to be a foul for you anyway. It's another one of those ones. There's a lot of these Bazunu ones where it's not by no means, you wouldn't even call it a mistake. It's just maybe he could have done
the accumulation of all of these goals there. That one of the three of us think he might be at fault at is nevertheless quite a concern.
So listen, we are.
I'll tell you who he's the same height as, Owen.
Who?
Ken Early?
He's the same height as. No, I'm taller than him. He's the same height as Kasper Schmeichel. He's the same height as Rui Patricio.
The height's okay then. We're happy enough with the height. Well, he's not much we can do about it at this stage.
Average. He's taller. He's taller than. He's the same height as Kepa, the great Kepa of Chelsea. Taller than Willy Caballero, Ederson, Dean Henderson, of course. Taller than Kevin Kelleher.
He's taller than Kevin Kelleher.
Taller than Hugo Lloris, the world champion goalkeeper. He's taller than. Taller than Jordan Pickford.
One of the tallest goalkeepers.
He's taller than Aaron Ramsdale. He's taller than Darren Randolph. He's taller than.
Matt Ryan. You've killed the emailer twice over.
He's not as tall as some other players.
Okay, but we don't.
He's not as tall as Robert Sanchez.
Can just continue to read this. As
Nick Pope.
Absolutely no problem.
Nick Pope.
Thank you, Owen.
Nick Pope is.
Oh Christ, he's talking about Nick Pope. Thanks, Ken.
Nick. Thanks, Owen. Pope is nearly 2 meters tall.
Thanks, Ken.
Each thigh to Nick Pope was the thickness of a horse's belly, narrowing to a green veined calf to the thickness of a foal. 3 50s of fosterings could engage with handball against the wideness of his backside, which was wide enough to halt the march of warriors through a mountain pass.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks for listening. Big week coming up in the World Service with Champions League, 90s hip-hop, yes, you heard that right, and loads more. To hear all of that, you're going to sign up on secondcaptains.com. You'll also hear every episode ad-free if you become a member. And remember, the Second Captains podcast is part...
Da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The Acast Creator Network.
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.